Session number 964. Lady Angela Limerick, Reel 1.
I was president of the County of London branch of the Red Cross, and president in those days meant the chief administrative officer, so that was a pretty full-time job. And then later on I was made deputy chairman of the war organization of the British Red Cross Society and Order of St. John, and I took that on as well, so I duplicated the two things. And I used to run from one office to the other at breakneck speed, because luckily they weren't very far apart and they were just within my sprinting distance. In fact, I remember on one occasion running into Lord Hawder, who was a member of our council, and almost knocking him down in my hurry. And he gave me one look and he said, "A woman of your age shouldn't run at that pace."
Could you explain what the war organisation was?
Yes, it was an organisation composed of equal numbers of British Red Cross Society and Order of St. John personnel at our national headquarters in London. And then throughout the country we had county branches, joint branches of Red Cross and St. John personnel who were responsible for running the services in their own areas. Getting their direction, of course, from the London headquarters, but always, if necessary, initiating any services which might be particularly needed in their own areas, because the needs did differ from one county to another. But we had this network throughout the United Kingdom, and that was able to carry on throughout the war, decentralizing the services from national headquarters. Some of the county committees were responsible for running, for instance, prisoner of war packing centres. Others had very big departments for our central hospital supply service, getting people to offer their services for either knitting or sewing or making garments or whatever it might be, or surgical needs, many tailed bandages and so forth. And it depended on the area what particular services were undertaken. They nearly all had their next of kin packing centres, so that relatives were able to go locally to pack the parcels needed by the prisoners of war with the special comforts and things which they were allowed to send from their own homes. And then, of course, we had to decentralise the prisoner of war packing centres. We had two in London, but then that was a very obvious target area, so we had some in other parts of the country as well to ensure that the flow of prisoner of war parcels shouldn't be interfered with in the event of a bombing raid. And indeed we had to close some of our prisoner of war parcel centres for that very reason.
How was the personality of the committee selected? Obviously when the war broke out, the Red Cross was or required men of greater expertise and the connection with the government and so on. How did this
Well, from the executive committee of the Red Cross, we discussed the sort of people who would be needed on a joint council of Red Cross and St. John members to carry out the war activities. And we selected a certain number of distinguished people we hoped would be heading the organization. Field Marshal Lord Chetwood became the head of the joint war organization. And Sir John Kennedy was his vice chairman, and Sir Ernest Burden was the deputy chairman, and later on I joined as the second deputy chairman. Field Marshal Lord Chetwood, of course, had very close contacts with all the service chiefs and the service departments, which was invaluable as we are a paramilitary organization. Sir John Kennedy was a very distinguished soldier. Had been invalided out of the army some time before, and in fact I think he'd been told he only had about 6 months to live, but he told me that he was determined to make the most of those 6 months, and in fact he lived for several years afterwards. And he was really rather horrified to find how little prepared the Red Cross was for war, and so he went out to the Spanish War in order to observe for himself what particular services he thought Red Cross should give in wartime. And when he came back, he was determined to gear up the organization to meet the needs as far as they could be foreseen then. And he did invaluable service in that way. Sir Ernest Burden had been finance minister in India, and therefore he was particularly useful in all the financial aspects of the Red Cross, which were manifold, as you can imagine, with the enormous sums of money we collected. And I'd had a long experience of Red Cross work since before the First World War, during the First World War, and so I suppose I came in under that heading. Well, then, apart from that, we had the heads of the departments on the council, the Prisoners of War Department, the Hospital Services Department, the Trained Nurses Department, all the departments, in fact, who were involved with the services we were giving to in the war. And then we had also the two medical advisors, Sir Alfred Webb Johnson, the surgeon, head surgeon, and Lord Hawdor, the head medical man, each the head of their own professions, to give us all the technical advice that was needed. Lord Iliffe was responsible for running the publicity and fundraising, and then various other sections of fundraising came in as the need arose.
And was the executive committee
able to take its own initiative during the war, or did it act more in response to the questions of the government, the vice president? Both. We, of course, worked very closely with the government, all their departments where our help might be needed, and were always prepared to take on any particular services that they asked for. And equally, on the other side, where we saw any gaps in the official services, and they were bound to arise, of course, at the beginning of the war, we were able to supply them in cooperation with the government departments or the local authorities, as the case might be. And it all worked extremely smoothly in that way. I think the secret was that we had very close liaison with all the government departments and with the local authorities, because in all the cases, in all our joint county committees, we worked very closely with the local authorities, and they were often able to ask us to undertake services which they knew needed doing, which they perhaps couldn't supply at the time, and equally we worked closely with them and were able to tell them of any ways in which we thought they could give more help than we could. Well, of course, it was really very largely a development of the services. For instance, in London, the authorities had made ample provision for the number of casualties they thought might arise if we had severe bombing raids, which of course took place. Hospital beds would be needed in great numbers, and that had been well thought out and well planned. But I think what perhaps nobody had quite realized was that if there were going to be all those casualties, there would be an even greater number of homeless people, because the casualties would be caused by buildings being destroyed and so forth. And there wasn't really adequate accommodation provided for the homeless. So rest centers had to be improvised, and supplies for the rest centers. People, of course, would have lost all their belongings, their clothing, their toothbrushes, everything you could think of. And we were able, from our stores and so forth, to supply these needs very largely, and also, which is perhaps even more important, to supply the personnel to staff the rest centers, because people arrived very shocked and shattered, as you can imagine, and it was essential to have first aid posts in all these places. Some of them were injured anyhow, too, and people who could help to restore morale and give them hot drinks and all the rest of it. And so we were able to supply a lot of these people, and indeed to help with the arrangements for the rest centers.
Did you have any
No, because there came a time when our people in London, we had about 10,000 of them working there, were very, very hard pressed, and most of them working all day and half the night, and as a result. And we felt that they couldn't go on at that pace forever. And so we asked all the branches, the neighbouring branches, indeed some of them far away volunteered, whether they could send personnel to relieve our people for perhaps a week or a fortnight at a time. And we had an immense response to that. Of course, we had to make arrangements for accommodating them while they were there, but they came all too readily. We could have more than we could really use in response to this call, and it was a very good thing. For instance, it enabled our people to go away perhaps to some place in the country for a short time and get a rest. And also, it encouraged people in the branches perhaps far away who weren't subjected to this sort of ordeal to feel they were taking a bigger part in the war effort.
You were head of the personnel department during the
Yes. Well, it was after I became the deputy chairman, yes. I don't think you can, because it was every conceivable type of person. I think that's what's so interesting about the Red Cross, that it attracts such very, very different types. I know that people seem to think the Red Cross isn't allowed to be a snobby organisation and have all the smart people in it. It's quite untrue. We have a big cross-section from every walk of life, and people have incredibly different interests. And there's some sort of bond which I think attracts them in the Red Cross, and you find that not only in this country, but in the countries throughout the world. So we didn't, I think we were always very well served in all the members we had. Of course, there came a difficult moment when there was a call-up of women. The Ministry of Labour set up a department for the recruitment and registration of women, and it was agreed that women from an early age, from, I forget what the age was, 17, I think, should be called up in relays according to age groups, taking younger ones first and going gradually up until we got, I think it was the 50-year-olds as the last call-up or last registration, I think they were actually called up. And I served on this committee, and on this committee we had to decide on the allocation of the women who were available in the different fields where their help was needed. The main ones, of course, were recruitment to the women's services, the ATS, the WAFs and the REFs, to industry, particularly munition factories, to agriculture, for the land army, and, of course, very important, for nursing. And we used to meet every week at the Ministry of Labour, under the direction either of Mr. Ernie Bevin, who was the chairman, a very wonderful chairman of the Ministry of Labour, or Mr. Ralph Ashton, who was his under minister, and later Mr. McCorkadale. And we used to meet every week and be given confidential figures from the various departments of their needs, as far as they could foresee them for the immediate future. And on that, we used to allocate numbers to the different either for services or industry or agriculture or nursing. There were certain reserved occupations, married women and small children and so forth, or teachers or people who were needed in hospitals, who couldn't be used for other purposes and so forth. But apart from that, the young ones were all called up and directed into one of these services. And we always made it quite clear that even if they were already in the Red Cross, if they were needed for one of these other immediate necessities, that they should be released. And we would rely on having the older people, or those who were tied to their own homes and could only give part-time work. And this worked very well, because we were determined that people weren't going to take an easy course if they thought it was going to be an easy course in the Red Cross, and not take on the further responsibilities if they were mobile. And it worked very smoothly. There were occasions when we had to fight the Ministry of Labour over this, because there were some little jacks in office who seemed to think that people who worked for a voluntary organisation, particularly if they were unpaid, couldn't be doing a worthwhile job. And I remember one instance where we had two key people who were in the younger age group that had been trained for this rather intricate and special job for a long time, who came within the category of those to be called up. And when they explained where they were working, they were told, oh, well, you can't be doing much good there because you're not paid and you're in a voluntary organisation. You'll go along with all the others. And we had to fight very much to get them accepted as reserved occupation, which indeed they were. And one found that working side by side, if people doing the same jobs, if they were not paid, it was suggested they weren't doing their job properly and weren't worthwhile and could be called up. Well, I think the general principle was that anybody who didn't need to be paid would work voluntarily. And of course, there were many, many more in those days who could do it than could do it now, for instance. And I don't think we ever had any problem in people wanting to be paid if they could afford to do it otherwise. Personally, I was determined that I didn't wish to know who was paid and who wasn't paid. I wanted to know who could do the job, and that was all that concerned me. And there was a department which would assess what their salary should be if they need to be paid. But I thought it was very important not to make a distinction between the paid and the unpaid. It was just the quality of their work which mattered, and not whether they, some of them, couldn't afford to do it without payment, and some of them could.
Were it nurses, trained nurses, working for Red Cross?
Again, it depended. Some of them were in a position to do it unpaid and did so very readily. Others, of course, couldn't afford to do it and were paid. But we tended, of course, in most of our in the trained personnel who were working in our convalescent homes or auxiliary hospitals, of which we had a great number in this country and some overseas, at home, it tended to be the women who would perhaps be able to do part-time from their own homes, rather than the mobile young trained nurse who would be prepared to go abroad with the services or indeed one of our convalescent homes. Yes. Well, I think one of the reasons was that there were two reasons really. One was that a big drive was made to get more auxiliary nurses by the formation of the Civil Nursing Reserve. Whereas there was no such thing in the First World War. If they were auxiliary nurses, they were BADs, or they weren't in the nursing service at all. In the last war, the Civil Nursing Reserve did recruit a great number of people for the nursing service who were not willing or anxious to be recruited through an already existing voluntary organization. They thought they'd retain their independence perhaps better by doing it in another capacity. So that was one reason why there weren't so many VADs. The other reason was there was a certain resistance on the part of one or two people in the nursing service, the Army Nursing Service, who were very anxious that the status of the VAD should not be in any way equivalent to the status of the trained nurses. And therefore that they should be regarded as other ranks and not have the privileges which they previously had. And this, of course, did rather mitigate against the recruitment. And in fact, in the middle of the war, and I sort of saw the sort of thing that should have happened, a departmental committee was set up by the War Office to consider the whole status and recruitment of VADs for the three services. And the Directors General of the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and the Matrons in Chief and the representatives of Red Cross and St. John, of which I was one, all sat on this committee for 5 months, we decided. It seemed to be a great waste of time. What the outcome was to be, and in the end the Army did decide that the VADs were to be treated as other ranks, and the Navy said, no thank you very much, we're very happy where we are, we don't want any change to be made. And so that's what happened.
Was this very deceptive for the Red Cross? Had you planning to provide VADs on the scale that...
We were prepared to, and the interesting thing was that when I went abroad, as I did two or three times, to visit various theatres of war during the war, I found that the matrons and the medical officers were screaming after the VAD. They would have given anything to have had more of them. But there was this bottleneck at home which made it more difficult. I think also there was another feature which, in the First World War, practically the only thing which the untrained Red Cross member could do, one who was prepared to train up to a point to work in hospitals, but the only work for them to do was as VADs. There were a few general service members who worked in the hospitals as cooks and housemaids and that sort of thing, but by and large it was the nursing VADs that were majority. Whereas of course in the last war there were so many other outlets for them in welfare work, either in the civilian field or as we then recruited for Red Cross welfare officers for the service hospitals, where they played a very, very big part.
Do you think this development in
Red Cross worked?
Perhaps the result of the
demand for not altogether. I think that we'd have found this demand existed and we would have tried to get people to meet it, whatever happened. But there certainly was a very much wider field in which they could work than in the First World War. And of course then the numbers required were infinitely greater as a result. And then there was the fact that the civilian hospitals took in service cases. There was quite a difference, of course, in the nursing service cases than the First World War, where they were entirely in service hospitals. in this last fall, of course, they were in civilian hospitals as well as service hospitals. There's very little distinction between the two. And therefore the civil nursing reserve took on more of that side than the VADs. Yes. Well, the purpose of them really was, in the first place, to visit the areas where we had Red Cross commissions, Red Cross VADs, welfare workers, civilian relief workers, ambulance workers, and so forth, and see that all was going smoothly and well there, to ascertain whether we were meeting the needs as far as it was possible to do so, or whether there were any new services or needs which might be required, to see always the military authorities and find out if they had any further wishes that we could undertake, duties that we could undertake, to tie up some of the problems which inevitably must arise always, whether the stores that we were providing were adequate or whether we were providing what in fact the army should provide, or if there was any special things that were stores were needed, whether more ambulances were needed. In other words, to find out first-hand from the people in control whether the thing was working smoothly or whether they wanted more help or whether there was overlapping or anything else. And then, of course, at the later stage, when we started in civilian relief work, there was an enormous new field which had never before been covered by the Red Cross, where we found a tremendous need for workers of experience, different kinds of experience. And then we had an organization going, which Lady Falmouth was responsible for, called Cobbishra, which included teams from a number of voluntary organizations who were prepared to do relief work overseas. Now, there was this tremendous need, with all the refugees pouring through, for help as the armies advanced to deal with the people who were flying back or fleeing forward, or as the case may be, according to the way the fighting was going. Lots of them were homeless, their homes had been destroyed, there were all sorts of welfare problems and clothing needs and shelter and transit camps and everything else. And the military authorities were very glad to have an organization that could help them over all this so that their fighting men could be used for other purposes. And when these other voluntary organizations wanted to help quite rightly, the army, the military authorities said, well, splendid, but we cannot have 15 different voluntary organizations all responsible to us. We must put them under one umbrella. And if the Red Cross is prepared to be that umbrella, then splendid, we'd like to have as many people as we can helping in this tremendous field. And so the Red Cross did become the umbrella, with Cobbishra, for these teams from the various voluntary organizations, the Save the Children Fund, the Catholic Women's League, the Jews, the Quakers, any number of organizations, the Boy Scouts, the Girl Guides, name them, and they're there, willing and anxious to help, each providing their own teams, specialists, some of them, others prepared to do any general work, all prepared to go out and do what they could to help in this tremendous problem. And it worked wonderfully well. They were all responsible to our Red Cross Commissioner, who was the liaison with the military authorities. And so they only dealt with one person in the allocation of the teams or any of the problems that arose. And he had to sort the thing out with the people who were there. And the Commissioner for Cobbs, the Red Cross coordinator for Cobbs, became part of our Red Cross Joint Commission, whatever it might be. So there was an awful lot always there, and to see how we worked in with the special government authorities who were undertaking the work on an official basis, organizations like UNRWA and various other ad hoc organizations appointed by the military. Yes, United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Organization. So it meant quite a lot of sorting out of problems there, to see that we worked closely together. We never worked under UNRWA. We made that quite clear. We would work as Red Cross, for obvious reasons. But we worked very closely with them and coordinated with them, with the military authorities. It went on for quite a long time. And we only pulled out when the army, who was no longer involved, of course, in the fighting then, could take over a lot of these services themselves and were prepared to do so. But as long as the need was there, the refugees were pouring through and the transit places had to be manned and so forth, we carried on. Oh, well now, which countries did I mean? A whole lot of them. I shall have to refer to my notes to see which they were. Well, I went out, the first time I went overseas actually was during the war, was in 1941 when I was sent on a whistle-stop tour of the United States and Canada, in the first place to thank all those who sent such immense help and support. American Red Cross and the Canadian Red Cross were magnificent, the things they sent to us. To thank them for what they'd done and to encourage them to go on doing it. Of course, America wasn't in the war then, and it was most encouraging to see the wonderful way in which they had mobilized to help. They had legion organizations working for, through the American Red Cross mostly, to send up this country, and what they sent was absolutely stupendous. Then the next time I think I went out was not until 1944, the early years in February 1944, and I went to North Africa and Italy and Sicily and Malta and Egypt and Cyprus.